honour to talk today about the Sakyadita conference that I went to a few weeks ago in the Blue Mountains. And Sakyadita is an international organisation that is in 45 different countries. It was founded in 1987. The word Sakyadita means daughters of the Buddha. And the organisation was founded to improve the status of women in Buddhism. So they've got thousands of members, and they have a conference every 2 years. The first conference in 1987 was in Bulgaria, and then all the other conferences have been in Asian countries, and this year the conference was in Australia, the first time out of an Asian country. And I went to the one 4 years ago in Indonesia, Yogyakarta, that had 1,000 participants, and then this one had 800, but they had to close registrations quite early because there was so much interest. So it's a big event. And about half the participants are monastics, so they are nuns from different traditions, particularly strong contingent from South Korea, but also Vietnam, Sri Lanka, and a lot of the Tibetan traditions as well. Some Zen as well, and it's mainly women, but there are a few men that come, and I definitely encourage men to come to go if they want to, because it's quite a unique opportunity to hear about what is happening in Buddhism around the world. So we can get a little bit caught up in our own practice and our own group and what we're doing, and it's really fascinating to hear what other countries are doing and other traditions and what the thinking is, some of the current trends and themes. So in the reason why Sakyadita exists is because in a lot of Buddhist traditions, the status of women is quite poor. For instance, a lot of traditions, can't get full ordination, so they can't get what's called bhikkhuni status. Another thing is that, in some traditions, a monk is always higher status than a nun. So if a nun might be 90 years old and meditating all her life and very wise, and there might be a teenage boy who's been a monk for 2 weeks, but she will have to bow down to the teenage boy because he's considered higher status, things like that. And so in some traditions, there's also the idea that women can't achieve enlightenment, but the best they can do is do good practice and get good karma. So the practice is supporting the monks to do their practice, look after them, and then hope for better rebirth next time around, and then maybe have a chance at enlightenment when they're reborn as a man. So you can see how for some of the nuns, some of the Western women who were becoming ordained, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, there were a few there. So Tenzin Palmo is a very key figure. She was the one who wrote the Cave in the Snow, and Karma Lakshya and a few others as well had a problem with some of those sort of attitudes. And also lack of education. So often nuns are more in the kitchen and they're not really getting access to the teachings. And Australia's been quite instrumental in that. One of the first bhikkhuni ordinations in the Theravadan tradition was actually happened in Australia with Ajahn Brahm and Bhante Sujata a few years ago. And they decided to give full ordination to a group of Theravadan nuns. And that was very controversial. And in fact, it's still controversial. So there was a lot of backlash against that action. So they have papers and also a lot of workshops. And each year there's a different theme, but also different themes emerge from their presentations. And what I noticed this time around, in contrast to Yogyakarta, were sort of two main areas that hadn't come across before, and one of them was talking about abuse in Buddhist communities, and the other one was environmental themes. And so today I want to talk about those that talked about abuse in Buddhist communities, and then my next talk I'll talk about some of the environmental themes that came up. So the issue of abuse is obviously very sensitive, and I'll talk about a couple of the papers that were presented. And so they were presented in front of all the delegates and also published, so they're quite public, but it's still very sensitive material, so we always have to be mindful of that when we talk about these sort of topics. And also the fact that men are, of course, also affected by abuse in Buddhist communities, and boys as well. So this is particularly about women's experience, but that's not to say that's unique to just women. So the first paper was given by Damsha Dyson, and she was a student of Sokyal Rinpoche. So a lot of you may be aware that there's been a lot of scandals around Sokyal Rinpoche. He, of course, is very well known for writing the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. But recently it's emerged that there's also been a lot of abusive behaviors. And so she became involved with him as a teacher after a series of traumas in her life, and felt very drawn to the practice, and then ordained and became part of his inner circle. And she described that there's a lot of physical abuse, so a lot of hitting. Was not uncommon for, you know, his students to have bumps and scratches all over their heads. But a lot of emotional abuse as well, so a lot of public humiliations and talking down. And also the young female students were pretty much on call to him 24 hours, 7 days a week. So there was a real culture of sort of sexual exploitation. And it was sort of the way they, you know, the students who were involved sort of justified it was, they called it crazy wisdom. So there's this idea sometimes that teachers, you know, crazy wisdom, but they know what they're doing, so you just have to go along with it. Sometimes there's quite a strong tradition of worshipping the guru, and something in Tibetan tradition called samaya, which is once you say you have a teacher, then you give your teacher a samaya, which means you basically complete and total obedience. And another quote that she said was, "We kept each other afloat by reflecting on the karma we might be purifying, and on the ego clinging we were loosening." So they saw it as, you know, useful steps in their own spiritual practice. And she said this was going on for years, and then two visiting teachers came. And they weren't really meant to talk to visiting teachers because they wouldn't understand. But then one of the teachers actually said to her, "This is abuse." And suddenly she could see what was actually going on. And she escaped and actually had to hide in India for quite a few years. Because, yeah, there was also, so, you know, a lot of pressure against her speaking out like that. And the other paper was a doctoral dissertation looking at two nunneries in Bhutan. So Venerable Dr. Tenzin Dada and Venerable Dr. Karma Tashi Chodron did this doctoral study of the two nunneries in Bhutan. And in Bhutan, a lot of, again, it's the idea of the guru worship, and the senior monks and the abbots in the nunnery have a lot of power. And there were quite a lot of examples of abuse again. So, you know, again, sexual exploitation of young nuns, also rape. And then sometimes when a nun is raped, she has to leave the community because she has broken the vow of celibacy. And apparently that's not actually even in the Vinyana, which is the guidelines for monastic living, that actually says very clearly that if it's not intentional, if it's forced, then the nun shouldn't have to leave. But often it ends up being the nuns having to leave. Also, examples of someone wanting to speak up, a whistleblower, and being asked to leave the community as well. And the other thing they found was quite common was this idea of the consort practice. So using the idea of tantric rituals as a way of getting young nuns to sleep with the senior monk, and which is not at all how it's actually meant to work. But the nuns didn't know, you know, how a tantric system is really meant to work. So they were quite vulnerable to being abused like that as well. So these are some of the examples, but of course in Buddhism, we also have a lot of, in Zen tradition, we actually have a lot of examples of when you read the old texts, you know, a lot of hitting. There was being hit and having the noses twisted and things like that. So we do have that as well. And in modern Zen, there's been a lot of scandals as well. So there's no end of stories about, you know, really very accomplished practitioners coming across from Japan to America. And again, that sort of sexual abuse of particularly young female students and vulnerable students. So, and this is something that seems to be, you know, normal. And we also know, of course, in churches and things like that, it seems to be quite common in religious practice, this sense of abuse. So a religious practice really asks us to be vulnerable. And that's really what I guess I want to sort of draw from that, is that we can't really do a practice like Zen without bringing vulnerability into it and also a sense of faith. And one of the things about the modern secular mindfulness movement is that it doesn't actually demand that of people. So it's a very individualistic practice. You don't really have a long-term relationship with the teacher. You learn it for a little bit and then you sort of go on and practice the technique by yourself. And so it doesn't ask of you to you know, make yourself vulnerable. It actually feels often a lot safer. And I think that could be one of the reasons why a lot of people do find that very appealing, because it feels so safer. You don't have to actually drop your boundaries. But when we do an extended long-term Buddhist practice or any probably religious practice, we actually need to become vulnerable to the practice. We can't keep doing it and just keep, you know, the boundaries really tight. And so we become vulnerable, first of all, to the Buddha's teaching, which is talking about things like no self, impermanence, you know, and if we want to have that sense of a long-term practice, it's actually asking us to deconstruct the ego and that sense of who we are. And we also need to be vulnerable to the teacher. So again, you can't have a long-term relationship with the teacher and just keep going there and be really defended. You actually have to open yourself up to the teacher and show your vulnerability. And then you hope that the teacher will use it for something that's healing and not something that's abusive. And of course, that's what happened in a lot of these cases. People brought their vulnerability to the teacher, and then the teacher, for their own reasons, used it the other way, used it actually as a form of abuse. And the long-term practice, again, is actually it's actually challenging and meant to sort of break us apart a bit. So our teacher, Jeff Dawson, talks about session, which is the intensive retreat, as being like going out on a boat and you leave your familiar land behind. So most of the things that you usually do that keep you sort of grounded and comfortable, you sort of let go of. They're not part of the retreat experience. And you go out on this boat, which is the practice and the sangha. And then you do that very intensive experience. And that's meant to sort of, over time, sometimes more suddenly, sometimes more gradually, deconstruct some of that sense of tightly held ego identity. But that can also come with quite distressing experiences. And as part of my thesis, I've been looking into some of the research into the adverse effects of meditation, and they're quite substantial and sometimes very serious. So things like psychosis or extreme mental distress leading to hospitalization or extreme depersonalization, but also suicide. So meditation intensive practice can have quite serious effects as well. And in a Buddhist tradition, that's actually considered, not necessarily the really serious ones, but it's actually considered part of the practice, is to go through very difficult times. So all the traditions have different ways of describing that. In the Christian tradition, you might talk about the dark night of the soul. And in Zen, we talk about makyo, which is the sort of afflictive experiences. But there's also something called Zen sickness, so Hakuin, who we had a reading from before, one of the very well-known Zen teachers. He actually talked about having an intensive practice and then having this Zen sickness for 2 years, which we now might call a nervous breakdown, and then eventually recovered from that. But, you know, quite serious side effects from doing the intensive meditation. And so the side effects in the Buddhist context can be seen as part of the practice that actually helps us on the path. And so we can use them as a way that's adaptive and enhancing growth, or a way that's maladaptive. And again, it's that relationship with ourselves and with the teacher that will determine whether that's actually something that's useful. But it's hard in the middle of when you're doing it to know what it is, you know? So you have to actually have a certain amount of faith and trust that this is still the right practice, even though it's actually quite challenging at the time. So it's really for us as modern practitioners, I think that's quite a conundrum to have. Or the other vulnerability I meant to talk about as well was the vulnerability to the community. So again, mindfulness is a very individualistic practice. But if we do a long-term practice like Zen, we actually need to be vulnerable to each other in the community as well. We're not just little towers sitting side by side, but we're actually in relationship to each other and opening ourselves up to the community as well. And again, that has a lot of advantages in terms of a long-term practice, but it also makes us more vulnerable because if the community has a certain culture, like in some of those that I was describing, then we can get caught up in that as well. So for us as modern practitioners, we have some advantages, perhaps, in terms of that we have maybe a feminist perspective, we have more understanding of what constitutes abuse, we might have more feelers out for some of the warning signs, perhaps. But then on the other hand, maybe we're not so good at some of the other aspects of the practice, which is the vulnerability and bringing that faith into the experience, really wholeheartedly giving ourselves to it, following the precepts, following vows, and the sense of relinquishing. So one of the things that's very obvious when you see a whole lot of nuns, you know, hundreds of nuns together, is, you know, how much they've actually given up in their lives in order to do the practice. And of course, we've given up very little, you know, in comparison to that. So that's something that we are not necessarily so good at. But on the other hand, we have some better awareness of boundaries and emotional issues and respect, you know, for each other and things as well. So there's sort of the two sides. But I think in terms of where we are with our practice, these are very interesting things to hold in mind. Where do we have too much lack of vulnerability, and where do we have too much identity, and where do we have too much vulnerability and just giving over of the self?